Schwester. Guna karma vibhagasaha. Tasya kartanam api mam. Yudha kartam avyayam. According to the three modes of material nature and the work associated with them, the four divisions of human society are created by me. And although I am the creator of the system, you should know that I am yet the non-doer, being unchangeable. Report by His Divine Grace. The Lord is the creator of everything. Everything is born of Him. Everything is sustained by Him, and everything after annihilation is in Him. He is therefore the creator of the four divisions of the social order, beginning with the intelligent class of men, brahmanas. Next is the administrative, kshatriyas, mercantile, or vaishyas, mixed passion, ignorance, and the shudras, or labor class, are situated in the ignorant mode of material nature. In spite of His creating the four divisions of human society, the Lord does not belong to any of these divisions, because He is not one of the conditioned souls, a section of human form, human society. Om Ganatana Mandasa Ganatana Sankara Takshara Mandasa. The Lord is here explaining how the different varnas work according to the different modes of material nature, which correspond to their mentalities. And He has created this system for the purpose of harmony and cooperation and a healthy interdependency between all classes and castes of men. This is simply a very general division, because actually the Lord has created everything and everyone to work according to the modes of material nature to which they are attuned, and by performing their dharma, which we use here in the psychophysical sense, and in varnashram, which is the social arrangement of that principle, the purpose being for harmony and support and cooperation amongst the four orders of society, as well as the four ashrams, as well as the 8,400,000 species of life. They're all meant for healthy interdependency. And therefore we see that under the spell of this bewitching technological society, which has everyone so, not everyone, but most of the population so enamored with its prospects for instant gratification, man has become so brazen and bewildered as to think that he's actually the master of material nature and the lord of these different species and orders of life. And everything, and as that syndrome of degradation of consciousness perpetuates and proliferates, man becomes very insensitive and conflicting in his dealings with others, be they other men, other castes, classes, religions, or species. And therefore we see that today's world is so so riddled with conflicts. Conflicts even between family members, conflicts even between spouses, conflicts between species, between nations, between castes and classes and religions, all of whom were intentionally, who were originally intended to work harmoniously. And the consequence of this degradation of consciousness and forgetfulness of the Lord's perfect arrangement is that man, in his imagined dominance over all material nature, strives to eliminate everything he finds inconvenient or opposing or conflicting or detrimental to his immediate gratification. And therefore you find, I don't know the statistics right now, but some years ago, the statistics were that several species of life were becoming extinct every hour, minute, something. Which means in an hour's time, many species of the 8,400,000 which the Lord created were becoming extinct. And of no concern to the technological mind initially, thinking that these different entities in most cases were just some pest. But then after the extinction of that species, realizing that another problem, an unprecedented problem, arose following the extinction of that species, which made man, through the process of cause and effect, realize that that particular species, which he took to be inconvenient to his sense gratification, was actually necessary and essential for the well-being of all the world. And now we find that the backswing of that thrust towards technology is that a lot of people are searching for their roots and trying to go back to a more organic, holistic way of life. Or look at it in the medical field. The holistic healing arts of former times being replaced by the quick fix techno-ethic of allopathic medicine has promised that man can conquer over disease and discomfort and pain and probably even death with a little bit more time. But that fallacy has not lasted long because people see that these quick instantaneous fixes, such as, for example, penicillin kills, what does it kill, bacteria or germs or what is it? Something. Infections. Infections means germs, right? So, very convenient. Your immune system's a little weak, you get an infection, you take penicillin, and it clears up. But then, after some period of time, the scientists discover that the penicillin didn't kill all the germs. A few survived and reproduced who are immune to penicillin. So what do you do then? Your immune system has become weakened by the introduction of this drug, so your own natural defenses don't work well, and then the drug ceases to be effective because it's simply the actual result of the drug was not the welfare of man, was the welfare of the germs who it was intended to wipe out. So in his mad infatuation with instantaneous gratification, over a period of time, man sees that he's creating disharmony in the natural order which Krishna created, with the resultant ill effects rather than well-being for humanity, which was initially desired. So here Krishna is explaining how, in regards to the four varnas, how he set things up. But he's also clarifying that although he set it up, he's aloof. He's transcendental to the system. he's not one of the four varnas or ashrams, although he may appear in any one of them, or any species of life for that matter, but he's not really one of them, because he's aloof, he's transcendental, he is not conditioned by the modes, but is the master of them. And that was explained by the Lord when, after delivering the wives of the brahmanas, who were so proud, thinking themselves superior by caste, and then coming back home, finding Nanda Maharaj preparing to perform a big sacrifice, and little Krishna inquired, "What is this sacrifice, and for whom is it meant, and what is the purpose?" And Nanda Maharaj said, "Well, Krishna's just a little infant. He's not going to understand any of this. Just ignored him." And then Krishna persisted, "Well, you know, secrecy is all right amongst those who are inimical, but not amongst family members. So please explain. Please answer my questions." So Nanda said, "Well, this is sacrificed to please Indra, who sends the rain, which is necessary for us agrarian people. Makes the grass grow so the cows can eat and give milk, which is our sustenance." And Krishna said, "Well, that doesn't make much sense, because the rain falls on the ocean, where there's no need for rain, nor is there anybody performing Indra Puja there. It falls on the rocks, where it doesn't do anything, and there's no grass to grow, there's no cows, Krishna, gradually through a series of arguments, he actually defeated Nanda Maharaj and said, and then he bewildered Nanda Maharaj and said, then Krishna started preaching karma mimamsa. That, you know, if there's some controllers like you're saying, then you don't need to please them by sacrifice. Because according to Varnashram, everyone is bound to do their duty. If you do your duty by karmic reaction, you get the result. So we're Vaishyas. Our duty is to protect cows and grow crops. If we do that, we'll get the result. The rain will naturally come because we're performing our karma. And the results have to come. I don't know if there's any Indra or such a thing. But even if there is, he's bound by karma too. He has to send the rains if we perform our duty. And then Krishna was kind of inferring that according to this karma mimamsa philosophy, even if there's a supreme being, he's not independent. He's bound by karma just like we are. If we perform our karma, he has to do his and give us rain. And Krishna was so persuading, he convinced Nanda Maharaj. Not really convinced, more like bewitched. But here Krishna is making it clear that philosophy he was preaching to Nanda Maharaj as a child is actually bogus, because here he's saying he's aloof from the system, he's transcendental. And the real reason he was preaching like that was just to, on a superficial level you could say, to infuriate Indra, who is already proud. And proud means you're going to become angry, you're going to offend someone. So Krishna just wanted to speed up the process and get it over with. So he made Indra made him infuriated. And then his wrath of trying to destroy the inhabitants of Vrindavan. And Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, which protected the cows and the Vrijabasis, but was really meant to protect Indra from his own ego, which is actually the only enemy that anyone ever has to encounter. And all the demons and obstacles we find in our sadhana and in the outside world, they're just projections of what's going on inside. And a lesson for our own edification. So Krishna arranged everything in creation perfectly. Not for our exploitation or lordship or enjoyment or control, but for our edification and our purification. And the way he arranged everything is not for competition, for supremacy amongst different varnas or ashrams or religions or species, but is meant for harmony and cooperation. The epitome of which is found in Braj, in Vrindavan. For example, in the 10th canto, as Shukadeva Goswami is explaining to Maharaj Pariksit how the beauty and freshness and everything blooming in the spring in the beautiful mystical forest of Vrindavan pass through its natural transition into summer, which in Vrindavan is excruciatingly hot. In Vrindavan, the summer sun can be deadly, and in midday, people don't even go outside. It's so hot, it can be deadly. But when Krishna was in Vrindavan, when spring, which we're being surrounded by now with all the fresh flowers and fragrances and rejuvenation of life, which was so dormant and is so grants and imparts so many lessons about how from how life always returns. Whatever it seems to be waning or dormant, life always returns, just as light always returns after periods of darkness. So, but when Krishna was in Vrindavan and the spring season transformed into summer with this burning hot, deadly rays, solar rays, nobody realized that it was summer. Because there were still cool breezes and fragrances of freshly blossoming flowers and birds chirping. Why was it that no one noticed that spring had passed and summer had come? Because spring is very refreshing and very pleasing. And for the pleasure of Krishna and Balaram, all of nature orchestrated in such a way as to maintain that fresh, cool, soothing, pleasing atmosphere. But on another level, you can say that it was so pleasing as spring, even though it was actually summer, because everyone was working together harmoniously. Just as the other night when we had our so-called class on the brick road, and everyone was experiencing, I think everyone was experiencing a taste of Brijavasi spirit, wasn't it? A taste of teamwork and harmony and working together cooperatively. It's very sweet. It's what we're always hankering for, because it is the nature of life in our homeland, that everyone works together cooperatively, supportingly, lovingly, in sweet relationships. And what makes relationships sweet? The personification and essence of sweetness is Krishna. And how does Krishna come into relationships? By working lovingly and supportingly and cooperatively for the pleasure of Krishna, with Krishna in the center. So because the Brijabhasis are always serving that humble, devotional spirit, when the spring season transformed into summer, no one even noticed. Because, for example, the clouds were always hovering over in Krishna and Balaram like umbrellas to protect them from the scorching sun. Now it's summer in Vrindavan, there's no clouds. Because the sun was so hot, the clouds would hover wherever Krishna and Balaram would go. And the breeze would carry fragrance of flowers and the mist from waterfalls is like air condition, natural air conditioning, carrying soothing, cool breezes throughout the forest. And although it was, technically speaking, the burning heat of summer, it was cool and soothing just like spring. Because of Krishna's presence, harmonizing everything, because of Krishna consciousness, making everything harmonious and cooperative and supportive, the atmosphere remained fresh, cool, soothing, pleasing, even though technically it was in the heat of the burning summer sun. And these lessons from Srimad Bhagavatam are not merely some philosophy to enchant our minds and please our academic taste for knowledge, but are very essential, crucial lessons for a world which is fraught with dangers because of a competitive, conflicting nature amongst the world's empires, which at any moment, by the instigation of Kali, who's the blood red clouds of destruction, could form on the horizon at any time to create such a devastation that a major portion of the population would be totally annihilated. And thank God for Srila Prabhupada bringing Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement to the Western world, which Sankirtan brings the spirit of Vrindavan. What is Sankirtan? We discussed previously. There's two definitions. It means everyone coming together to congregational chant of the holy name. It also means utilizing everything in the propagation of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. And Sankirtan is the essence of the Brijabasi spirit. It means everyone coming together, sacrificing all competitive, selfish, combative motives, and simply for the pleasure of Vaishnava's Guru and Krishna, working humbly, supporting one another, assisting, encouraging one another to serve better. Okay, some element gets turned up and the heat is oppressive. It should be an inspiration. It should be a signal, an impetus to all others to serve better, to compensate, and in this way to increase our service for the pleasure of Vaishnava's Guru and Krishna. And this brings the Sankirtan movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the spirit of Vrindavan, even into the material world. And we can experience it any time, in any place, that spirit of cooperation is there, and it's contagious in a good way. Even the elements of nature, when devotees come together congregationally, serve humbly for the pleasure of Krishna with him in the center, then even the natural order becomes so adjusted harmoniously. As in Vrindavan, even in the burning heat of the summer, it was like a kirtan. The bees and the cuckoos and the swans and the cranes and the breezes and the thunder and everything was creating a very pleasing vibration. And sound is the most subtle element coming from the ether, beyond which is only the holy name. And the holy name, through the medium of sound and ether, creates that harmonious vibration with the holy name in the center, which harmonizes things and gives us a taste for that nectar we're always hankering, which is our homeland, which is our roots in the land of our soul, Goloka Vrindavan, from where we have come and from where our hearts will always be anxious until we return. So this new Vrindavan, Prabhupada said, is none different from Vrindavan. And we we can experience that. We can taste that sweetness when we work together, cooperatively, harmoniously, humbly, for the pleasure of Vaishnavas, Guru, and Krishna. And if some element becomes overbearing, as the summer sun in Vrindavan, it should be a call, a wake-up call, an inspiration, an impetus for all others to work together more harmoniously, more lovingly, more devotedly, in a compensatory way, and that will adjust everything for the pleasure of Krishna, which ensures our own pleasure, because we are part and parcel of Him. Thank you very much. Anybody want to share any realizations, appreciations, realizations? Because I don't really have any. So what is the need for rainforest in some other part of the world? Yeah, but what does it do, practically speaking? What is the nature of that rainforest that is so essential to us right here and now on this lawn for our own physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being? Do you know? That's a good part of it. Wintertime home for the birds. What do birds do? They eat the insects. What do you do if there's not sufficient birds to eat the insects? You get insecticides and poison and contaminate everything. And everyone gets cancer even though they don't smoke. This is the consequence of destroying the natural habitat of living entities who we don't realize their importance until we've already jeopardized their own well-being and realize that it's integral to our own. So then the question is there any hope? Okay, if right at this very instant all damage to the ecosystem ceased, it would take 50 years to find out how much damage to the ecosystem has already been done and what the consequences will be. Take 50 years to realize the damage done to this moment if all damage stopped at this instant. But I can tell you, if that happened, which it can't, we would find that man has done more damage to the ecosystem than man can ever redeem or correct. For example, when I was in school, I didn't last very long, but I learned a couple of things, like, oh, technology is so great. Now we have this nuclear energy, and it's the greatest. And I asked, well, what about the nuclear waste? And the teacher said, that just goes in the ocean. It doesn't hurt anything. So I asked her, well, according to what you said about the half-life of that radioactive waste, the steel and concrete caissons in which it's encased when it's dumped in the ocean, they're gonna be finished before the radioactive waste. What happens then? The whole world's gonna become radioactive, isn't it? You know, the scientists and technology will deal with it before that comes. So really, they're gonna go down to the bottom of the ocean and bring up the nuclear waste. What are they gonna do to it? Well, send it to outer space. Oh, so instead of contaminating the ocean, you're going to contaminate the universe. And then she got mad and told me to be quiet. And then she did a demonstration to teach us all how to use Geiger counters. So why do you want to do that? I mean, what does a common person need to read? You have to be technological. And she picked on me because I couldn't figure out how to use a telephone. So I thought, well, I'll teach her a lesson. Just a little kid, you know. So she brought in a piece of celery and stuck it in a vase. I thought, that's nice. And then she put radioactive water in it and told me, now you go with a Geiger counter and read how that radioactive material is going all through every cell and part and parcel of that celery. I said, okay. I went up and I knocked the thing over, and the radioactive water went all over the table and down on the floor, and the teacher went running out screaming. And all of a sudden, I know all these red lights and noise and guys with, I don't know what they looked like outer space. They had these, they came running in, they told us all to get out. I said, what kind of advancement is this? And I flunked that course. And what was the question? Rainforest. Yeah, well, she told me I was just some dumb farmer. I said, well, that's all right. That's what you need in your class. Oh my gosh, she had no sense of humor. But, you know, I never had any faith in technology, and after that class, oh, but the thing is, if all damage to the ecosystem ceased at this instant, in 50 years, we'd realize that man has done this many times more damage to the world than man can ever heal. I'll tell you another story. When I was a kid, I overheard a conversation that my parents were trying to arrange for me to meet with this Mataji, but they weren't going to let me know it. It was like a setup. Okay. So I ran away, and I went off into the mountains. And then my cousin went with me, and I used to sleep very soundly, so I fell asleep. And I rolled down the mountain when I fell asleep, but I didn't wake up. And then a bear came to drink out of the spring. My cousin, he was a city boy, so he woke up and saw a bear. He was terrified. He reached over to wake me up, and he was gone. So he thought the bear ate me. So then he passed manure in his sleeping bag and ran back and told everybody that a bear ate me. So I thought, well, this is great. You know, no family encumbrances. My cousin looped and everything. So I just stayed up in the mountains. So I was on the top of this mountain, almost on the top. And there was a little spring that came out. So, you know, Krishna provided water for bathing and drinking, and then there was enough vegetation and herbs and everything all around, so I could just stay there. So then one morning after the morning program, I took a bucket of water from the spring and put it on the campfire. And then I was shocked. There's a little fish in the water. So I really quickly rescued him out of the ashes and put him back in the water and looked, and I saw he was all right. I got him just in time before he got burned. I thought, well, how did this fish get on the top of the mountain? Because this little spring came out, and there was a pool of water there, but then about 20 feet down, you know, it flowed for about 20 feet beyond the pool, and then it went back down into the ground. And it didn't resurface anywhere that I ever saw. How did the fish get in this little pool of water on the top of the mountain? I had no clue. Until like 30 years later when I built this dam out here. No, it's actually the upper one. When I built that upper pond by Nitaigor, I came back, you know, a few weeks after I filled it, and there was fish in there. Now, my question was never answered. So I asked the conservation man, and he said, well, the ducks do it. The ducks pick up fish eggs wherever they land, and they stick to their feathers, and then they fall off the next place they land. And this way, you know, fish travel, even though there's no waterways by which they can, they travel in their eggs on the feathers of the ducks. Anyway, back to your question. What that taught me was that, and I've seen it confirmed in so many other ways, if you create the proper environment, then the appropriate species will appear. Now, the word used, like even in agriculture, you know, sometimes plants appear that you didn't grow there. Sometimes they're weeds that you don't want. Sometimes they're herbs that are very helpful. And, you know, they just appear. The word is volunteer. They come from somewhere. So then the question is, if a species of life is actually extinct, can it reappear? Now, by Darwin's explanation or something, it's questionable. But by Krishna's arrangement, we've seen, or even, you know, in New Vrindavan, which used to be three villages, Balulabad, Vrindavan, Madhavan, three little villages. And whenever there was a need for some species, like a horse or a dog or something, they'd just appear. Usually we didn't even know where they came from. You create the proper environment and the necessary ingredients, they volunteer, they appear from somewhere, by Krishna's grace. So seeing that lesson confirmed over and over, I have faith that whatever species are extinct will reappear whenever man gets his act together and creates a sustainable habitat for life. See, every one of the 8,400,000 species of life has some element, some role to play in our own emotional and physical well-being. And every time one species becomes extinct, which quite a number of them have since this class began, we are all diminished in some way. And the only way to really compensate for that is to take shelter of Krishna. And if enough people will take shelter of Krishna, it will create sufficient harmony to heal the damage that technology has done. And then the devastated forests will replenish themselves and the missing species will reappear. And some harmony and balance can be restored if a sufficient percentage of the population takes to Krishna consciousness. So it is our dharma, it is our duty within the social order to try and inspire others on that path to take shelter of Krishna, which is our only hope. That'll attract. And then the people and the money and things appear to be a shortage of now. Whatever is necessary will come. And if something that is necessary doesn't come, then we know that Krishna is instructing us that there's something we have to do to correct the situation. Something in ourselves and amongst ourselves that has to be adjusted. Time of sharing, because I don't have any realizations and I'm dependent on all of you for inspiration.
I think I heard once Prabhupada said in 72 hours the whole world.
He said different things. He said, you know, 18 days, the battle of Kurukshetra was won by the Pandavas they didn't have any, they were no match for the Kauravas as far as militant strength went. But still, in 18 days, they won. Because Krishna was on their side. So Prabhupada said, why? No, what was it? Huh? Yeah. That this could just spread like wildfire. Yeah. It's up to Krishna. But Krishna, he works according to his devotees' desires. Just like Sanatana Goswami explains that when little Damodar pulled that grinding mortar and pulled down those two big Arjuna trees, he was feeling that I have to do this to please Narada. Narada cursed Nalika Varamani Griva to become these trees, and I have to fulfill that curse that they'll be delivered by me. Krishna was thinking like that when he did that. It's not that he wasn't aware of Narada's curse and who they were and everything. He knew that. And he was doing that because in Vrindavan, like Satyavrata Muni begins his prayers to the Supreme Controller full of eternity, knowledge, and bliss with great Aishwarya reverence. And as his prayers progress, they become sweeter and sweeter until he's offering his obeisances to the rope which bound the belly of Krishna, meaning the belly of Krishna contains all of creation. And that rope means the Brahma Jyoti. So he's offering obeisances to the Brahma Jyoti, but I don't want that. And I don't want liberation. But Krishna says, well, liberation's nice because that ensures no more birth. No, I don't want it. Let there be birth and death or anything as long as this darshan view remains in my mind. And Sanatana Goswami is drawing out from the prayers of Satyavrata Muni how Krishna loves to be dependent upon his devotees. Krishna is independent. He's Isha. But he loves to take a dependent role on those who serve him in love. So if the devotees in the Sankirtan movement have sufficient will that this movement spreads, Lord Chaitanya will do it. So it is up to us to cultivate that desire and that compassion and that dedication, and then Krishna will fulfill the needful. It's not dependent on our calculations, it's dependent on our purity. I mean, calculations, everything can be utilized, but the real force is the purity. I mean, Lord Chaitanya, he inaugurated a massive kirtan with almost instantaneously. Oh, the Kazi, with his thousands of Patan cavalry soldiers and infantry soldiers and swords and cannons is going to stop this movement? We'll see. Everyone assemble with a torch at dusk. We'll see what kind of Kazi is going to stop me. And then, right at dusk, all the torches burst into flames. It was like the Brahma Jyoti. It was like daylight at night. And where did all those torches come from? Who told everybody to light them all at the same instant? It was Lord Chaitanya's will. Because the devotees feeling so oppressed by the Kazi. And in that night it was proven that the flower is mightier than the sword, and the holy name is more powerful than the mightiest brute strength in the creation. Revealed, nothing hidden that will not become known. And that's usually kind of scary. Oh my God, you mean everybody's going to see my anarthas? What it really means is that we all have more potential inside us than we're aware of. And when we put ourselves into circumstances or submit ourselves to circumstances that demands more of us than we're aware that we have, we'll find unlimited resources within us. But it's just like when the Nagapatnis went to find something nice to offer to Krishna, and they saw, oh, my God, there's a customer. Who put that there? Krishna put that there. Krishna has put similar things inside us, but we'll never discover them or know them or experience them until we want to offer our best to Krishna. And then we'll open up that chest and there it is. But don't ever think that you produced it or created it or deserved it. It's a gift. The gift should be accepted with tremendous gratitude and appreciation and reciprocated accordingly. Anything else? I'm very ignorant, so you all have to help me with realizations. Understanding this Bhagavad Gita.
The question is kind of off.
It's not a weapon. Four symbols: conch, club, disc, and lotus. And the club are for demons. The conch is for victory, and the lotus is for the pleasure of his devotees. In another sense, they're weapons because Krishna's mercy is the most powerful force in creation. And his mercy is revealed through his devotees. Lord Caitanya leads an army of Sankirtan devotees with the supreme astra weapon, which is his beauty. It's just indefeatable. It's unconquerable. It's supreme. It's irresistible. So Lord Caitanya showed that night at that big Mahasankirtan, that beauty conquers over brute force. Kindness is more powerful than militant strength. And the holy name is mightier than all the swords and cannons assembled together. Demolish it, throw the pieces in the river. And, that was. But you know. Anyway, we better not get going on that one. There's a lot to that pastime and a lot of sequences to it, which some night we will discuss. Another very important element of everything we discussed is appreciating other devotees and appreciating diversity in unity and unity in diversity. You know, false ego induces people to think that their particular caste or creed or color or whatever is superior, and will bond with those and suppress and the rest. It just makes everything sour and is totally disempowering as an attitude. But when we appreciate the unity in diversity, or the diversity in unity, that creates a very empowering spirit. Jagannanda Pandit, you know, he was always getting angry at Lord Caitanya. They were always getting in these quarrels and fights. And even though he tried his best to control himself and not do it, it had to happen because he's Satyabhama, you know, that was their rasa. Whereas Gadadhar Pandit, Lord Chaitanya could not do anything to get him upset with him. I mean, such extremes of diversity, but such unbreakable harmony and cooperation and love amongst them. Not in spite of it, but because of it, because they had appreciation for that. So that's the mood we're trying to emulate in the personalities we're following, in the mood we're imbibing by coming together, chant the holy name, discuss the glories of the Lord, and serve his mission. All right, thank you very much.